But before we go into Toynbee, I want to say something about two other modern approaches to the meaning of history, two other modern secular approaches. One of them is the psychoanalytic interpretation of history, and then, secondly, the approach taken by Oswald Spengler to the meaning of history. Then we will have the Toynbee film, and following it, we'll make some general comments about Toynbee and open the whole business to discussion. Psychoanalytic interpretation of history has become more and more widely practiced in the last two or three decades. Psychoanalytic interpretation of history, of course, is an application of psychoanalytic theory to an understanding of what history means. An effort is made, in quotes, to psychoanalyze historical characters or epochs, thereby determining what the real motivations are lying behind the activities of these individuals or lying at the root of these epochs. We want to say a word or two about what psychoanalytic theory maintains, and then we want to see what ought to be said about this from a critical standpoint. There are, as I'm sure you realize, a number of psychoanalytic schools. There is the most orthodox psychoanalytic school of all, which is the Freudian school. Then we have Adler and Jung and any number of other varieties. Fromm, Horney, etc. All of these have in common an assumption with regard to the nature of human personality. And this assumption is the iceberg assumption. Here we have an iceberg, believe it or not. And this iceberg consists of 90% ice underneath the water and about 10% ice above the water. The psychoanalytic assumption is that the human personality consists of conscious and unconscious realms, conscious and unconscious areas of operation, and the unconscious is far more profound and far more significant for human motivation than the conscious. You should realize that this is a model. It is not intended to represent either an iceberg, really, because it would be a pretty sloppy iceberg artistically, nor is it intended to represent a kind of scheme of the human mind. It isn't that the psychoanalytic theorist feels that there is actually a two-level operation. It's rather that the mind operates in two ways, and the most influential way is by way of unconscious influence. The variation among the psychoanalytic schools has to do with what is considered to be the fundamental motivation operating in the unconscious. That is, what is considered to be that factor within the unconscious that has the most influence on conscious development. It's assumed by the various psychoanalytic schools that it is possible to isolate a single consideration, or at least a major consideration, which can make understandable much of conscious activity which otherwise would not be understandable. Thus, Freud, up until quite late in his career, concentrated entirely on the libido as the fundamental factor in the unconscious. Toward the end of his career, he added a second factor, the mortido. The libido is the life wish, the thrust toward preservation and extension of life. The mortido is the opposite, the thrust toward the termination of life. The libido is often considered to be the sex urge in popular parlance, but Freud did not consider the libido simply to be a sexual panting or anything of that kind. It went on a somewhat more profound level than that. Be that as it may, it was this kind of motivational consideration that Freud felt was basic for explaining a great deal of conscious activity. For Adler, popular parlance, pride is the factor of greatest significance in determining conscious activity through the unconscious. It was Adler who stressed the inferiority complex and the inferiority complex develops as a result of the pride factor in the personality. For Jung, we have something more complex. For Jung, we have a gestalt, a pattern in the unconscious, which reflects what Jung called the archetypes or archetypes of the collective unconscious. For Jung, the unconscious of the individual must not be understood in isolation. The unconscious mind of the individual is the product of a racial unconscious in the broadest sense. It's a product of the development of the human being through the centuries. The unconscious of the individual reflects in some sense the unconscious of the human race as such. Jung isolated a number of archetypal factors. These are basic images that he found present in a variety of cultures and situations. For example, in analyzing the alchemical writings of the Middle Ages, Jung found that the same symbolism is employed as is found in the dreams of the contemporary businessman. Jung concluded from this that the fundamental needs of the personality have remained constant from a century to century, and the same symbols can be found in all cultures, all climes, all situations. Jung developed from this the belief, the theory, that what human beings need more than anything else is a reconciliation of opposites within their personality. Human beings have personalities that are at war with themselves internally, and the task of life is to find a reconciliation of these opposites. He talked a great deal about a conjunction of opposites. And one of his last works was entitled, and a Latin title was used for it, the Conjunctio Oppositorum. Now, there's no point here, and we haven't got the time anyway, to go into the variations in other psychoanalytical schools of thought, but the fundamental principle should be clear, that there is one factor or a concatenation of factors within the unconscious that influences the development of conduct on the conscious level. The psychoanalytic schools were also fairly well united, and are united, on the principle that this unconscious development has early influence on the personality, and that early experiences are especially important for determining the pattern of unconscious life, so that later on in life, people tend to act out the problems that have developed during the early years. Thus, much conscious activity in adult life turns out to be explainable only in terms of childhood experiences or experiences very early in one's life. Now, what happens when this sort of thing is applied to history? An effort is made, of course, to find the unconscious motivations that are at the root of the historical activity. What is done on the external, conscious level is not taken to have significance necessarily on that level. It's necessary to penetrate more deeply, to discover what the real motivations are underlying the activity. An effort is made in conjunction with this often to try and find what early experiences of a historical character would have an influence on the activities that he is engaged in. Now, let me give you two or three examples of psychoanalytic interpretation, and to be perfectly frank, these are somewhat extreme and somewhat bizarre examples, and those of you who have been assiduously reading In the Shape of the Past will have come across these yourselves. However, though they are bizarre, there's no question about that, they are not atypical. For the first comes from Freud himself, the second comes from Erik Erikson, who is regarded as one of the foremost psychoanalytic theorists and practitioners at the present time, and the third comes from a much less well-known figure, but one who has published in psychoanalytic journals of repute. One of Freud's books is entitled Moses and Monotheism. And in Moses and Monotheism, Freud goes to work on Moses. Freud asks, why is it that Moses got these God ideas that he did? How can you explain this picture of the deity as it's set forth in the first five books of the Bible, in the Mosaic writings, or those writings attributed to Moses? Says Freud, the answer to this is that Freud has projected personal conflicts of his own, unconscious conflicts, and he has created a massive father figure. And the God which he describes is such a father figure. The wrath of this deity is explainable in these terms. The monotheism that Moses develops is a monotheism which reflects his own inner conflicts. Erik Erikson, in his book Young Man Luther, goes to work on Brother Martin, and he attempts to explain how it is that Luther broke with the church authority of his day. He explains it as follows. Luther was reaching an identity crisis. He had chafed under the authoritarianism of his parents and of his teachers, and finally he struck out violently against the authority structure of his day in the broadest sense of the term. He hit it at its center and at its circumference by dealing in the way in which he did with the church, the authority that covered both heaven and earth. A psychoanalyst by the name of Feldman analyzes the activity of Benjamin Franklin. He asks, why is it that Benjamin Franklin was concerned with inventing the lightning rod? The explanation is that Franklin had a problem when he was a little boy, a problem with the windbreak. Now, the windbreak, for those of you who do not work in this area, is the expulsion of anal gas, or putting it in the most unpleasant terms possible, it is the fart. When Benji was small and did that sort of thing, as children are wont to do, his parents objected, and he therefore acquired a feeling of being repressed, and this feeling he carried on into adulthood. And naturally, as an adult, he was interested, therefore, in controlling explosions. Boom! Thunder is an explosion, and the work on the lightning rod is, therefore, clearly able to be understood. Now, what exactly do we do with this sort of thing? In the first place, we certainly do not knock the idea that there are unconscious motivations that influence conscious activity. That is surely the case. Granted that psychoanalytic investigators have not engaged in the kind of statistical activity that we would like, granted that it's very difficult to find a statistical level of significance in many psychoanalytic investigations, granted that Freud himself probably did not do depth analysis on more than 50 people in his entire career, but granting all of this, in the literature of psychoanalysis, it's quite evident that the case made for unconscious motivation has a genuine basis for it. The trouble comes when the assumption is made that all activity, or even most activity, derives from unconscious motivations of which the person himself is unaware. It's one thing to say that activities do, on occasion, reflect the unconscious life, or can reflect the unconscious life. It's another thing to say that all activity is subject to this kind of unconscious governing. This is the difference between arriving by scientific method at the influence of the unconscious under certain controlled conditions, or under conditions where the evidence is clear, and maintaining the scientific assumption that all activity derives from unconscious motivation, which is not evident to the person who is engaged in this activity. To argue the universal statement goes beyond the evidence. It would be impossible to provide evidence that would offer that kind of proof. Consider it logically. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that everything that we do is really not done for conscious reasons. Let's say that everything that we do is subject to unconscious motivation. Now, if that's the case, what is the motivation that leads the psychoanalyst to analyze motivation? Merely the fact that the psychoanalyst says that he's doing this for a particular reason is not, of course, the reason, because there is an unconscious reason which lies behind his conscious guidance. Now, you see that this turns into a reductio ad absurdum. It becomes impossible to establish the motivation for anything. If you look in some psychoanalytic literature, you find this kind of an answer sometimes given. Granted, the unwashed layman does not know the real reasons for his motivation, but we do. And the reason that we do is because we ourselves have been analyzed. We have gone through analysis. Well, if you think about this for a moment, that likewise is reductio ad absurdum. Because if you say, I know my motivations, know my motivations because I have been analyzed by B, and B says that he knows his motivations because he's been analyzed by C, you can see that this becomes ultimately an infinite regress. Well, maybe not an infinite regress, it goes back to F, which is Freud, because Freud did the first professional analysis along this line. However, if you read Ernest Jones' two-volume biography of Freud, which is a masterpiece, Jones himself is a psychoanalyst, you find that it's awfully difficult to maintain that Freud was terribly well aware of what he himself was doing. That is, Freud had quite a number of hang-ups that become clear in this descriptive this descriptive biographical material. So evidently, one cannot begin with the assumption that nobody really knows his motives. There are several psychoanalytic jokes that connect with this. For example, the two psychoanalysts meeting on the street, one says to the other, "Good morning, doctor," and they pass, and the other one says, "I wonder what he meant by that." Now, if you think about this for a moment, it's possible for the first one to say, in overhearing this, "I wonder what he means when he asks, what did I mean by that?" Huh? But then, of course, it's possible the other one to say, "What did he mean when he asked, what did I mean when I asked, what did he mean by that?" See? And so on and so on and so on. The thing becomes an infinite regress. You have got to start on the assumption that some conduct, at least, is understandable in its own right. And that when a person says good morning, he might conceivably just mean good morning, and that it can rest there. In fact, you need to go on the assumption, which is exactly the reverse of the scientistic form of psychoanalysis, that what people say does mean what they think it means, unless there's good reason to feel otherwise. You must go on the assumption that what a person does and what he says does represent what he is actually endeavoring to accomplish, unless his conduct is so bizarre or so out of line with his explanations of it that you need to appeal to something else. This means, of course, that you can and should use psychoanalytic technique where you are forced to use it. But it is not a normative technique. This, of course, brings us to the three analyses that I was just talking about. When Moses talks about God, he claims to be talking about God on the basis of what he himself has objectively experienced. There he is, minding his own business, or Pharaoh's business, in Egypt. And lo and behold, he is yanked out of this by the objective power of God, and he is put through a series of experiences. The whole impression you get is that Moses wouldn't have chosen this for the world. In fact, when he is expected to speak in behalf of the God who calls him, Moses says, every time I attempt to say anything, I stick my foot in my mouth. You've got to supply somebody else. And Aaron is brought in as a spokesman. And you see Moses as a reluctant leader who comes around as a result of God's action. Now, maybe this isn't the case. Maybe the whole business is a gigantic psychological problem on Moses' part. But if you think it is, you've obviously got to offer some historical evidence to show that what Moses said happened didn't happen. It isn't enough to say, I know so much about human nature that I can go back X number of years into the past, and I can say, poor Moses, no matter what he said, the actual situation was otherwise. In fact, that kind of argumentation is analytically meaningless, if I can appeal to an expression employed by contemporary analytical philosophy. How exactly would it be possible to show that Moses objectively had these experiences? You see, no matter what is contained in the records about him, the interpreter, a la Freud, comes back and says, of course he puts this in objective terms. That just shows how deeply unconscious the whole thing is. But you see, under those circumstances, there's no evidence that you could supply, even in principle, to show that this had happened. Now, that kind of reasoning, therefore, is off base. In the case of Luther and the Reformation, it's interesting that it's practically impossible to find any instances of Luther having been ground down by either parents or teachers. There are some instances. For example, Luther got whacked good by his father. He records this in Table Talk later on in his career. And he was once whipped by his mother for taking some food out of the kitchen when he was told that he shouldn't. And once upon a time, a grammarian gave it to him on the knuckles for not knowing his Latin declensions. But on the basis of two or three instances like this, it's terribly difficult to build up an identity crisis, which will then explain the Reformation. Because the fact of the matter is that in Saxony in those days, the kiddies tended to get whacked good by their parents for making off with the food from the pantry. And the reason that people knew Latin so very well then, and they don't know it now, is because their teachers were rather hard on them when they didn't know their declensions. The problem then becomes explaining why there weren't little Luthers hopping up all over Saxony. As for Feldman on Benjamin Franklin, probably the less said the better, but there is a characteristic line in Feldman's analysis of this, and I quoted it in The Shape of the Past. It says, Feldman, you may well ask for the evidence that Benji had this problem of the windbreak with his parents. Says Feldman, science must supply what the biographers have missed. And I'm quoting almost verbatim. You can get the whole quotation in The Shape of the Past. You notice how the term science is being used here. It's being used as equal to scientism. Scientism must supply what the biographers missed. That is, I, Feldman, know so much about the nature of human motivation that I don't need any facts in the case of something like this. I can simply express what must have been the case in regard to Franklin. Well, human nature is just too complex for anybody to operate deductively in this fashion. Feldman doesn't know human nature that well, and neither do any of us. That's what makes history so much fun and also somewhat difficult when you take it as a subject in university. There are subjects where you can learn a certain number of fundamental principles, and then you can pretty well answer any question asked simply by deductive analysis from these assumptions. In history, you can't do this. People who try to do this get into a great deal of trouble. Some of my students will do this sort of thing from time to time. For example, I will say, what were the results of the 30 Years' War, theologically? And they will say, well, the causes of the 30 Years' War, that they memorize, the causes of the 30 Years' War are such and such. On the basis of this, I can conclude that the war must have had the following results. But of course, this is utterly illogical because it assumes that you can employ a deductive kind of scheme in dealing with history, and you can't. You've got to build it up inductively. Nobody knows enough about any particular in history to be able to develop all of the causal results of that particular factor. There's just one way to know what the results of the 30 Years' War were, and that's to learn them, you know, discover them, to find them out by induction. And there's only one way to know whether Benji had difficulties with his parents in the expulsion of anal gas from the anus, and that's to see if there's any evidence about this. And if there isn't, well, you better drop the whole business. It might be that Benji was simply interested as an adult in stopping lightning from burning barns down. There's just that possibility. And it would be better to go on the assumption that that is what he's doing, unless proven otherwise, than to take the reverse procedure. This is simply a reflection of that old philosophical principle that if a thing looks like an onion, smells like an onion, tastes like an onion, it just might be an onion. We have no objection whatever to the careful, intelligent use of psychoanalytic technique for illuminating aspects of the historical drama which are not explainable on the basis of conscious and objective considerations. We have no objection to this, but we do have objection in assuming that nothing is really as it seems to be. As a matter of fact, that's a psychological problem in itself. People who go around always thinking that other people are after them, even though there is no evidence of this, are put away by the very people who, when they analyze historical problems, often engage in exactly the same kind of procedure. All right. Before I go on with a word about Spengler, I want to make a point which arises out of a question I was asked at the end of the last class period, and I wish that we had had time to have this asked publicly, because the question is a very, very good one. You remember that I put on the board the schema of the Marxist view of history, the monolithic Marxist conception of history, and I pointed out the parallels between this and the Christian view of history. I emphasize that the Marxist view was a secular redoing of the Christian view of history, or the biblical view of history, if you will. I was asked afterwards, what gives me the idea that the Christian view can come to realization when I claim that the Marxist view will not come to realization because of the conception of human nature that the Marxist held? Remember, we pointed out that the Marxist had a very naive view of human nature, and I emphasize that the fact is that even with the means of production taken care of in society, there is no assurance that people would live sweetly and peaceably with each other. Now, if that's the case, what gives us the idea that the Christian view of the finality of things would come out any better? Why wouldn't people be creating the same fusses in heaven or in the Christian millennium as they presumably would do in the Marxist state? The answer to this, and we'll be coming back to this later on in the course on several occasions, is that Christianity claims the possibility of transforming human nature. The Christian claim is that what God did in Jesus Christ provides for each person the potentiality of a changed nature. If any man be in Christ, said the apostle, old things are passed away. Behold, all things become new. Meaning that it's possible to have one's basic motivational structure changed. Now, whether such a thing is possible or not is going to depend upon a couple of considerations. It's going to depend upon whether Jesus was who he said he was, whether he's actually able to deliver the goods. And this has to do with whether he in fact performed what he is said to have performed in history. And secondly, of course, it has to do with whether or not one is willing to test this thing out, since a change in motivation is something that you can only discover in yourself within the framework of your own personal actions. Some people have said to me, when things have gotten particularly awkward in a discussion, you prove to me that Jesus Christ can do such and such, and you prove it right now, and you prove it right here. Now, the answer to this is, it seems to me, an analogy. Suppose I wanted to show you that there was electricity, and you said, well, now electricity has certain characteristics, and I said, well, I can't see it. You say, well, of course you can't see it. It isn't of that nature. But given certain conditions, it's perfectly possible to demonstrate that it's there. And I say, go on. I'm not going to listen to that sort of thing. If it's really there, you show it, and you show it right here and now. And finally, in frustration, you say, all right, come over here to this electrical plug and just put your fingers into it in the following manner. See? Now, unless I'm willing to do this, unless I'm willing to satisfy the conditions involved, I'm not going to discover there's electricity there. I mean, barring a situation where Franklin's lightning rod is not present and the lightning comes down and strikes me right here, it's going to be very difficult for anybody to demonstrate electricity to me as long as I stand here and absolutely refuse to abide by the conditions involved. The conditions are you've got to go to the plug. Now, by the same token, the change in motivation that Christianity claims is possible, you can realize, but only if you satisfy the conditions. And the conditions are set forth by Christ himself. The conditions are not that you go leaping into this blindly. To enter into it means to base your personal decision on what he in fact has done in history. And the evidence for this is tremendous. And we'll go into it in considerable detail later on in the course. We go into it on the basis of what he in fact has done in history, and then we present ourselves to him in the words of the prayer that he himself described, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief. It isn't necessary to have all the problems solved, but it's necessary to be willing to move into this frame of reference on the basis of what he's already done. Nobody who has ever prayed that way and meant it has found himself out in the cold. The change in motivation is very clear. I've never known anybody who has operated in that area without discovering it, and I can certainly say this for myself. So one thing that Christianity has going for it that no other approach does is that it recognizes what human beings are like, that they can't establish utopian solutions to the problem of history. But at the same time, Christianity provides a means by which people can get beyond that problem through an actual change in their motivational structure. Okay, now I want to say a word about Spengler, and it will be very rapid. Then we will go to the Toynbee film. Spengler is very interesting as a philosopher of history because he is an example of a reversion in modern times to a cyclical view, of history. Remember, we mentioned how among the ancient Greeks, who did not have the benefit of a revelation, history was explained by the continual repetition of events. Spengler, who did not consider himself a Christian in any sense of the word, and who was entirely disenchanted with efforts such as Hegel's or Marx's to explain history as an ongoing movement toward a goal, recognizing that neither Hegel nor Marx nor the others were able to justify their approach, goes back to a cyclical view. Says he, civilizations go through the same life cycles. And these life cycles are directly analogous with human life cycles. Birth, growth, maturity, decay, and death. Spengler thought that he could establish the life cycle of civilizations and that they all had approximately life cycles of the same length. In other words, civilizations remain in existence about the same length of time. He plotted the collapse of previous civilizations, and on the basis of this, he felt that he could extrapolate to our present civilization. And that's the reason for the title of his book, The Decline of the West. The Decline of the West. He was convinced that the West was in its last stages. In The Shape of the Past, I've outlined some of the criticisms of Spengler, and the criticisms are quite severe. For one thing, he gets civilizations all to have about the same length by that ancient and popular method of the Procrustean bed that we talked about in other class sessions. How is it that all civilizations end up with about the same life cycle? Well, the idea is that the brief ones are stretched and the long ones are chopped off at either end. The fact is that it's awfully difficult to create a similar life cycle between Chinese civilization and Iranian civilization, for example. Very difficult, but Spengler manages it. His critics have pointed out that this has involved a certain amount of expansion and contraction of historical data. Then there's the assumption that the whole thing is based on to begin with, namely that the systems created by human beings must go through the same cycles as the human beings themselves. Now, if you examine this assumption closely, you see that it has no necessitarian character about it at all. The Mona Lisa does not seem to show the same life cycles as Leonardo da Vinci. An engineer can build a skyscraper, or a philosopher can set forth a system of ideas, and these don't show a parallel pattern of development, decay, and death to the life of the individual himself. In fact, one of the reasons why human beings engage in creativity is that they want to provide something which will not suffer the same limitations as their own lives. In the film that we're going to see in a couple of seconds, Toynbee makes an allusion to Spengler in saying, "I don't believe that civilizations must go down the drain on a predictable pattern." And Toynbee is quite right in noting this. But Spengler is a pretty good indication that if you are a modern secularist and you want to interpret history and get some meaning for it, you really got only a limited number of choices. You can, A, bastardize the Christian view of progress. But we saw last time that there are logical reasons why that cannot possibly succeed. What happened to Hegel and to Marx will happen to anybody who thinks that he can see an ongoing movement toward a goal without any benefit of a perspective outside of the world. The second possibility is to go back to a cyclical view. But the cyclical view has the problems in it that we were just mentioning. What makes one think that the systems of relations human beings create necessarily parallel their own individual experience? This is an assumption and an unproven one. Then there is one other possibility: despair. And this is the existentialist view of history, which is, in effect, there are as many histories as there are individuals who observe events, if one can even speak of events objectively outside of personal experience. This results in a pluralistic situation and a solipsism, since it becomes impossible to use one historical interpretation to criticize any other one. I've gone into some detail on the existential interpreters of history in The Shape of the Past. Toynbee hopes that he can somehow get out of this dilemma by employing some motifs of the biblical view of history, and yet not taking as scientistic an attitude as people like the psychoanalysts or Spengler. And now is our opportunity to hear Toynbee discuss his own viewpoint. About the first half of the film consists of anecdotal material. I was mentioning this last time, in which Toynbee talks about his Uncle Harry and his mother and all kinds of interesting things like this. And this is great fun and really useful, because Toynbee speaks with such a heavy Oxbridge accent that it takes about half the film before you can understand him. In fact, this film is more difficult to understand than the Tillich film, which some of you will be seeing next Monday in the theology, in the other course, in the course on contemporary religious thought. It's often easier to listen to a foreigner speak English with his foreign accent than it is to understand an Oxbridge Englishman. But stick with it, concentrate good and hard, and by the time the film reaches the point where the young and very naive teaching assistant says, "But Professor Toynbee, what is your theory of history?" By the time you get there, you ought to be attuned so that you can hear how Toynbee answers that question.
World sessions, old and new, are this man's province. The 5,000 centuries of recorded time, his span. 10 volumes comprising a study of history, his life's work. The National Broadcasting Company presents a conversation with a distinguished British historian, Professor Arnold Toynbee, and Christopher Wright, teaching fellow in Harvard University.
They'd be much farther away, wouldn't they?
Oh, it would. It'd be out of Tenderville somewhere, but I think we shouldn't still very easily find it, even in a legend.
No, I don't imagine anybody wanted
it. Well, as a matter of fact, we can't spend very much time on end away in the country, so we have to make do with the country and the town, and that's one of the advantages of London, because here you have it. When I look up from my work at my desk, I always catch the green of that tree and that budgie down in my own garden down there. Curious thing, you know, about where one's roots are. I know very well that my own roots are here in London. And I suppose that's because, as a child, I grew up here when I was very small. Well, of course, I don't mean to say that I haven't got a feeling for places in the country. Well, Christopher, you remember that part of Yorkshire where you and your family came to visit me once between the wars. I've got a greater feeling for that than I have for London. I have a great feeling for places in Italy or Greece, but London somehow is a place where I have to do the main part of my work, I always find.
Now that your book on the study of history is finished, and quite a few volumes now, I suppose you wrote most of that here then, didn't you?
Well, I did write those for the war, since the war, here in this room in London. At least most of them. I wrote part in Princeton, New Jersey, and quite a good bit on the ocean, going to and fro. Now, these six other volumes, I wrote most of them up in Yorkshire, which we were talking about just now.
How long did it take you to write it all together?
Well, it took me 27 years, because out of that came a bite of 7 years bitten out by the Second World War. But it's amusing to think of. I got my notes all written out. I thought that I'd polish it off in 2 summers, and it took me 27 years.
You know, I've often wondered, just how did you get started on this enterprise?
Well, I think the explanation is really my mother. Not that she suggested it, but she just was an historian herself, and I grew up assuming that I was going to be one too because of her. Here's her picture, and it's always on my desk, looking quite young. She was in one of the first class of women to take a university course at Cambridge, England. And when I was small, she used to put me to bed at night. She used to tell me the history of England in bits till after about a year we finally had gone all through it.
I seem to remember you referring to some other members of your family, too. Some uncles, weren't there?
Oh, yes, there were. There was my great uncle Harry, for instance, and the ship captain.
Oh, yeah.
He put the world on the map for me, with Cape and India and China and all the oceans of the world. Such a contrast to Uncle Paget, who was a very precise scholar. I remember his sending when I was about 16 and telling me I ought to specialize. But deciding straight off I was going to do that.
Quite a variety in your family then.
Well, I suppose the family name is best known to my Uncle Arnold, whom I was named for, who died as a young man about 30, and the first settlement in London was Toynbee Hall, founded in memory of him.
But with all the variety in your family, interesting to figure out just who was the main influence. How'd you become an historian? I suppose it was your mother's influence, wasn't it?
I'm sure it was my mother, but of course, at one stage anyway, that was rather overlaid by my school, because I went to a very old-fashioned school, Winchester, founded at the end of the 14th century, and they had what was then a very up-to-date 16th century classical education, which I still came in for, translating bits of English into Latin and Greek. Mm. It's rather surprising how what seemed like rather a narrow form of education did broaden one out there. Now, Emerson, my master, thought that Emerson was just the thing to translate into Platonic Greek prose, so that introduced Emerson to me.
That's an interesting idea, how even a very specialized schooling can lead to a variety of interests.
Well, yes, it does. For instance, yes, I'm thinking of Herodotus. I had to translate an awful lot of Herodotus out of the Greek when I was at school. Now, there's an old Greek historian writing in the 5th century BC, and he becomes a sort of second Michael Harry to me, opening up quite a large amount more of Asia for me. Why, I was so interested in reading Herodotus at school that I had a sort of childish drawing book, and I wrote an essay and illustrated it too, all out of Herodotus.
Do you still have that book?
Well, yes, I have. In fact, it's just here behind me.
Could I see it? I'd like to.
Well, you certainly can.